Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Scare Zone. And this time, not only do we have Christopher Ripley who's here. Chris, can you hear me?
I can. How you doing,
yes.
Logan?
Good. I'm doing well. This time we have the other guy on the show. He made it in because we had some technical issues last time, none of which are his fault, just it's what happens. We have with us Scott. Scotty Too Hotty Garland. Scotty there.
How's it going, guys?
We're thrilled to have you on. Now, those who don't know the wizardry that we did last week, Scott was there the whole time. But
you can actually hear my laugh a couple times. You know that, right?
You can? It just like comes in, there's just a person laughing in the background? That's great.
It sounded like a laugh track.
I'm not even sure how that's possible, but I'll have to go back and listen. But Scott was there. He was there in spirit, if you will. He was there. He was commentating. So we'll have to go through a lot of that again. But Scott has been a theme park junkie for years. If you follow him on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere, social media, you know that for the last few years, at least I have been following the last few years and noticed all of these adventures he's gone on, from abandoned amusement parks in New Orleans to all the way, obviously, living in – he's our local. Scott, you're a local in the Orlando area. So why don't you tell everyone just a little bit about yourself, maybe those who aren't familiar even with your wrestling career, and then also how you started falling in love with theme parks.
Yeah, sure, man. Yeah, I've been a pro wrestler for 27 years. Moved to Orlando in 2003. And it was just one of those things where I was vacationing here all the time, and I really loved it. You know, I've been coming to Disney since I was 2 years old, and we decided that we would move down here in 2003. And you know, I was with the WWE at the time, so I could live anywhere. So for the first year, we were snowbirds. We did the winters down here and the summers up there, and then we liked it so much that we just decided to do it full time down here. And so yeah, and as far as Halloween Horror Nights goes, I never really went until I think it was 2008 was my first year, and it was never anything I was really interested in even doing. And a friend took me along, and man, I fell in love with it, and it's really become my favorite thing to do in Orlando now.
It is a lot of fun. Have you noticed? I've kind of noticed this because I host a Disney podcast that not just wrestlers in general, because there are definitely wrestlers that love the theme parks. We hear about them all the time. But there also seems to be a interesting crossover in the communities, even the people behind the scenes that work on these things that are also wrestling fans.
Yeah, you know, I've always argued, and people laugh at me, that they're really very similar. You know, if you take out the final product, it's entertainment that takes you out of the real world in your life for the time that you're there. And that's the goal of the whole thing, whether it's wrestling or Disney or theme parks, is just to kind of remove you from the real world and you know, have you have fun.
Absolutely. And I have seen that. I mean, we'll make little small wrestling references. We've done it on this podcast, but definitely on my other podcast. And I'll get at least a handful of tweets with people going, oh man, that was a reference to this angle back in 97. You know, right. And it's interesting to see that.
You're going to get stacks from Derek Berg, and I know it now.
I know. Yeah, Derek is definitely a wrestling fan. He was out there yesterday petitioning to get Cody Rhodes and Zack Ryder on his podcast too. So that's what was happening in that world. But Scott, you also come from a different perspective. I think I like that. You know, I have small kids. Chris, do you have kids?
None I know of.
None that you know of. So no. So Chris, someone come from some world, no kids. I have small kids who won't be going to Halloween Horror Nights for, I mean, who knows? At least another, let's say, 10 years at the minimum. But you have kids and children of age that can go and experience this. What is their reaction like, and what's it like as a dad being able to take your kids?
Yeah, it's awesome. You know, it's what's funny is I don't know if they really are of age. You know, I don't know. Well, my daughter is almost 15, and my son is 11. He'll be 12 in October.
Yeah.
But he was, up until last year, he was terrified of going. He was terrified of horror movies. And then we went, and both the kids love Halloween Horror Nights, but my son has just become, I mean, when I say obsessed, that's an understatement. I mean, he literally is on the internet every day watching YouTube videos of old stuff and saying, hey, Dad, did you know they can, you know, Halloween Horror Nights 2, like, this happened. And he's just telling, he knows more than I do. Like, he should be on here with you guys, really.
Yeah, because I think I saw your picture from even like a week ago or something like that at Universal, and he's wearing a Halloween Horror Nights shirt.
Yeah, I just picked up two Halloween Horror Nights shirts for him recently off eBay. And he actually dressed up as Jack for Halloween last year, which was pretty cool. I'll send you the picture to put him up, or I can send him out on whatever, if you want to retweet it, whatever. It was really cool.
Yeah, that is cool. It's got to be cool for the people that make Halloween Horror Nights too, to see the fact that these original characters, and we all love the original characters, are inspiring enough to kids to, you know, be their Halloween costume for the year. I think that's so neat and so different, and is kind of unique to the fact that you live in Orlando, the fact that people will be able to get it because you're inundated with the marketing every day. You see the billboards and you see the ads on TV. So people will probably go, oh yeah, he's Jack. It's easy enough right there. But if you obviously did that here, you'd probably get some just odd looks of, why is that 11-year-old
clown,
an evil clown? But so yeah, I think I went the first year I was 14 or 15, maybe 15. I think I was 15, and that felt about right. Like that felt about right for me. I enjoyed it. The houses, I did maybe a few houses, but I remember sticking to the scare zones and maybe just the Bill and Ted show. Bill and Ted was my entryway to the event in general, just because I'm a huge fan of that film. Or both those films, but of that franchise. So that was my entry point to it. And my year was also the year that 9/11 happened. So it was 2001. And the whole theme, I'm sure Chris can touch on, I'm sure it was in his book, the whole theme kind of changed at the last minute. So it was a little less grotesque. It was definitely calmed down. And Jack was more of a, Jack was ended up being the lead character, being the icon. And he was more of a comedian who just kind of go around making jokes. He wasn't necessarily out there, frightening you. But yeah, so it's a, I like hearing your perspective as a dad. That's something I,
yeah, I don't know if every 11-year-old would be okay doing it though. You know, I don't know. I have mixed feelings on it, but he loves it. Both the kids are great with it. And, but like I said, I don't know if every 11-year-old would be okay with it. But
what do you think about that, Chris? How old were you when you went to the first year?
I think I was about 15 as well, around that age.
Yeah.
So it was just, you know, it was something that I just never experienced before. It was just completely different in every way. And you know, as you said before, it's this unique event that makes us all keep coming back.
Yeah. So, I mean, it does. I've come back now. Like I said, I've only missed two, and Chris, you're coming over this year again. And it's not like it's an easy for Scott. He's got about a 20-minute drive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he can go tonight if he wants to. I mean, it's not open tonight, but he could go theoretically. But Chris, you've got quite the travel to make it over here.
Yeah. I've got that big pond in the middle, to cross.
Not quite the even me. If I drove, I could theoretically be there by 2 a.m. if I got in a car right now. So I mean, I feel a little bit blessed at that, but not likely to make that drive tonight. But it's it's a different world. And we've talked about, last week we talked with Julie Zimmerman, who talked about sort of the humble beginnings of Halloween Horror Nights, which I think was really interesting to me as a fan that got into it, quite a many years into it, to see how it started, to see how much it was like the Wild West and was calm. And today we have on the show, we have Jason Sorrell, who was honestly for the Disney community, a lot of people know him as an Imagineer, worked a lot on the rebooted version of Star Tours, and added a lot of the flair to the Haunted Mansion, like the Leota tombstone that's out front. He was just a huge part of that. And now, but he actually kind of had his humble beginnings was at Halloween Horror Nights. We'll get to that later on. But guys, I want to touch one more to Scott before we move on to getting to obviously that big announcement that happened this week. But Scott, so you take your kids and you're able to go. Is it something that as a local, how do you feel like you experience it differently? And what kind of perspective do you bring to it? Because do you go, I assume you go multiple nights. It's not something you're going in buying the express pass, knocking out one night, or is it you're spreading out your time?
No, we do the frequent fear pass now. I think the first couple of years we only went, I only went, this was before the kids went, I would only go for one night, and I would do the express pass. You almost have to if you're only going to go one night. But now we do the frequent fear pass. So we didn't do the express pass, but this year the plan is to save up all year so we can do the express passes for every night. We'll see if we make it, but we thought it would be really cool.
Maybe we'll start like a GoFundMe for you.
Why not? Why not? Every other wrestler has one.
That's true. And that's, speaking of that, so you're obviously a professional wrestler, but when it comes to, or sports entertainer, whatever you'd like to say, when it comes to your work in Orlando, that's not all you're doing now. You're still out every weekend wrestling pretty much, but during the week you also have other gigs in locally.
Yeah,
right?
I do a little bit of everything, I guess. I'm, like you said, I'm wrestling pretty much right now every weekend coming up for the next next month or two, I have something somewhere. I was just telling Chris before that I just took dates for three dates for England in July. I have Mexico in 2 weeks, I think, and something really, really cool. The dates aren't completely solidified, but it looks like it's going to be August around 5th to the 18th. I'm going to Iraq for a couple weeks.
That's hardcore.
Yeah,
that's
just for a handshake tour with a couple of other wrestlers and comedian and stuff. So that's super cool, you know. But no, I also I have my real estate license. I do that a little bit, and just recently I started an eBay business, and what I go out looking for to sell is theme park stuff. You know, that's my thing. So right now I'm looking at from Islands of Adventure. I have it's about a 12 inch dragon from the original Dueling Dragons that they must have sold in the park. I can't find anything on it, but it's really heavy. And it's like resin. It's like a dragon head. It's so cool, you know, living here, the stuff that you come across. I think 2 weeks ago, I think I sent you a picture of it, Logan, but it was a Disney Auditions poster from 1982. So, you know, the same year that Epcot was opening. So, you know, I assume it was for that. And on the back, you know, it was heavily framed, so it was obviously at Disney or somewhere around here.
And you're just going to picking these up at different garage sales?
Wherever. I have people calling me now, like wanting me to come buy their stuff. So I'm like, I just started it kind of as a hobby and messing around, and it's turned into like a real deal business. And
send me the link. We'll make sure we'll put it up on we'll put it up on this episode in the so if you click your screen, if you're on iTunes, you should be able to see a link directly to it right now. If you click it, you should pop up Scott's eBay store, but we'll also put it on our website and our social media. That is something that we're seeing, you know, and I think, you know, I mentioned this last week, and Scott, I'd love to hear your point of view of this, is that a couple years ago, even the Halloween Horror Nights community, as something that was constantly engaging with each other throughout the year, and social media and Facebook groups and all that have helped, was kind of quiet, and it was kind of small. It was kind of the people who knew about it. Now, a lot of people like me went every year, but it wasn't something that was as maybe celebrated or as highly collectible. And we're seeing right. that now, and we're seeing very much how I feel like it was. And this, look, this just even points to our show. I believe there's one other Halloween Horror Nights podcast that exists. Now, if you look at Disney back 10 years ago, 8 years ago, 5 years ago, there was probably a handful of Disney podcasts. Now there's about 1,000 Disney podcasts that exist. I would probably put
1,000 on just 1,000 are on today, just today.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a hugely not only saturated market, but it's also something that has obviously exploded. And I feel like we're on the verge of that somewhat with Halloween Horror Nights and with Universal fandom, because it is becoming more accepted that the Florida traveler is not just staying at Disney. And for you, Scott, as someone who lives there, works there, and also is a part of this community, do you feel that way? Do you feel that way when you're going through the parks, that you're seeing a bit more of this camaraderie, you know, kind of the old Disney flair?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would say in the last 2 or 3 years, I feel like Universal has just exploded. You know, it's you know, crazy busy now, and there's a really cool vibe over there, I think, and it reminds me of old Disney, actually.
And it does feel that way. To me, it feels the same, like you said, old Disney, because I think when we were going there, a lot of it had to do with a time period, Scott, that you moved to Florida, and when I was living in Florida, it was a time of, sadly, some of it was time of the recession and things like that. So the crowds weren't insane at Disney. They were bad, but they weren't like they are now, where there's literally not a good day to go.
No, there's not an off season anymore.
Halloween Horror Nights, same kind of thing there. You're now waiting in line. If you don't have that express pass, you'll be waiting in line 3-4 hours for some of those houses later in the night. It's it can get a bit intense, but I love seeing that this community is coming together. Chris, as someone who is like a historian, I know you felt that way about the community. We talked about that last week. When it comes to navigating Halloween Horror Nights, do you feel like we are at the point where it is, if you can't go more than one night, the express pass is inevitable?
Yeah, the express pass is. I mean, I don't know if I mentioned it last week or if it was on our other podcast, but they're now saying that when you buy the express, you have to look at the wait time in the standby line, and the Universal are saying that you're going to be waiting half of what the standby is.
I don't like that at all.
I know. It's a bit of a step change, but I think it's probably to lower people's expectations, because I remember, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, people were getting the express pass and thinking, well, why are we queuing? We should be able to walk on this house straight away, you know.
And some you do get to. Some you do get to walk on, and like, you don't stop and you walk straight up. But yeah, even with the express pass, I've waited half an hour.
Yeah, I have as well.
But those are when those houses are, like, it was like when American Werewolf had a 3-hour wait, you know, to get on. So it still felt like a breeze, even though it was, you know, 90 degrees in the middle of October. But hey, that's why, have you guys ever done like the tours, the all right, like not the Behind the Magic or not behind the Magic side, that's Disney, but like the behind the scenes tour. I've done one of those, but you guys ever done like the RIP VIP tours?
Yeah, I was thinking of doing it this year as well.
Well, I feel a meetup coming on then, guys. I feel like we can go in and split this and get some listeners and let's all do it, because I want to do it as well this year. I think we have to. Now it's part of our job.
Yeah,
that'd be cool.
So yeah, let's work that out. We'll see. Once things pick up, I think we should find a date and let's do it. Now, the house that's surely gonna get a lot of attention was announced this week. I was expecting, honestly, if I'm being totally honest with Chris and Scott, that sort of the American Werewolf of this year was that Texas Chainsaw House, because it was we're gonna brand it. It's gonna be the big house. It's gonna be the first thing we announce. Hasn't been here since 2007. Really, has never been here at all. And they kind of ran the same idea just this past week with the announcement of The Exorcist, to even a even bigger applaud, I feel like, from the community, because this is something that kind of hasn't been a part of it. They're definitely marketing it as something that's never been a part of Halloween Horror Nights. But Chris, we kind of know that's not necessarily true.
Yeah, I think Julie kind of let the cat out of the bag there, that they may or may not have had a Reagan-looking person on a bed flying around the park. So
yeah, so it's happened before. And I think even like 2007, someone posted that there was at least like a roving Reagan at one point. But what do you guys think of this? But in general, this is the first time it'll be a house, a permanent, not permanent, but a featured house that's exclusively The Exorcist from that film. Well, a lot of people say the scariest movie of all time. It is personally giving me some concern of going through it, but I'm excited about that. The fact there's actually a house that I'm a little bit like, you know, I'm going to tread lightly here going through this thing. But Scott, what do you think about The Exorcist?
I think it's really cool. I think, like you said, people look at it as one of the scariest movies of all time. So, I mean, but I think it's perfect. I wonder, you know, is a pattern here as to what the houses are going to be, you know, a second mid-70s film, you know,
back to back.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
Chris,
though,
what do you think? What were your initial reactions for The Exorcist?
Well, the first thing that came to mind was last year when they upped their game on the puppets for the American Werewolf House.
Yep.
So now I'm thinking to myself, well, they've got those people on board. What can they do with the Reagan character? You know, they can really go out there with her, have her coming out of the ceilings and downstairs and all sorts. So really excited for that.
Yeah, it'll be that weird mix of the one that could genuinely frighten you, but you want to make sure you go through, you know, at your own pace to experience it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that I'm looking forward to. It's genuinely like Texas Chainsaw there's no part of that franchise that does anything for me when it comes to being like, oh man, I'm not a huge chainsaw guy. It's more like I'm going to do it. It'll be fun. The Exorcist is, I'm genuinely curious. And like, even like I said, like a little bit concerned and how they pull it off without it kind of coming off either hokey or without it being like, you know, people protesting the sacrilegious elements of it. You know, like I'm curious where the line is on it, because it is that sort of, it's still a film that's kind of taboo that everyone's seen and everyone knows about The Exorcist, but that isn't quite it's not Jason or Freddy. It's not an easy cartoon, you know, kind of feel.
I'm pretty sure they used to have a rule, perhaps they still do, about using religious iconography in the houses.
Yeah.
So I would imagine a lot of that stuff will be scrapped or really toned down.
And that's hard when it's The Exorcist.
I know.
Out of the whole movie. Mm-hmm. Now, I was doing a lot of research because I didn't know a whole lot about the creation of the film. So I've been reaching out to a lot of people. We're going to try to get a guest on. No guarantees, that had to do with making the movie or making the book. So I'm in touch with a lot of people. And those guys that made it, even the director and the writer, definitely had deep faith, still do, and we're writing it as not necessarily as a horror movie, but we're writing it as a movie of almost warning. So I'm curious if that can kind of, maybe they can get away with it a little bit more, saying, well, you know, it was written as almost a Catholic film, you know, so let's see where we can go with it. But it is that kind of concern that I have with how far, said, like, they've said that they're going to stick away from the religious iconography. Well, it's called The Exorcist.
Yeah.
that may be a problem. But Scott mentioned this. Chris, do you think this is a trend? Do you think we're seeing mid-70s horror or these kind of, you know, darker, more, even, I don't want to say indie horror, but more, you know, do you think we're going to see this more featured? Or do you think this is it?
Well, I tell you what I think it is. I think it comes back to the Harry Potter watershed moment. As soon as they got J.K. Rowling on board and delivered for her, they could go and tell anybody in the world who owns any IP, Universal delivers. So I think Julie alluded to it, that she wanted to do an Exorcist house from the beginning. So they've obviously wanted to do this for years. Perhaps it's taken this long to get it onto the table. So if there are other properties, and we know Mike on Twitter has mentioned it, there are other properties they've been trying to get over the years. Perhaps now we're going to see, you know, any and every house they've always wanted.
And I love that. And I love that because I think the IPs that we've been dealing with in the past, and look, I mean, when I was talking to Scott and Chris earlier this week, because it was kind of teased, hey, there's going to be an announcement today. Of course, I was talking to Mike the night before. He could have said, hey, Logan, by the way, you may want to hold off on that episode you're about to put out. But of course, I wake up, I talk to Mike at 11 o'clock at night on Facebook. I wake up and there's a tweet, hey, there's going to be an announcement. I'm like, great, we're behind. And you know, we were talking, thinking it was going to be Krampus. And even the tweets that were coming out from Universal Hollywood almost led you to believe that it would be Krampus.
Old Murdy likes to play with the fans.
I know. So I was fully convinced. I was like, it's Krampus. And that actually, in a weird way, I'm looking forward to, because Krampus is pretty fun. It's the exact opposite of The Exorcist. Have either of you guys seen that film? Do you think it's and do you think it's going to happen?
I keep hearing rumors about it, but I did see the film, and I thought it was okay.
Yeah, it's just kind of a goofy movie.
I think it'll be something different.
Yeah. Chris, did you see it?
No, I haven't seen it yet. I've watched some of the trailers online and what have you, but I think it does lend itself to Halloween Horror Nights House from what I've seen.
So do you feel like that's a solid rumor, or do you think that now this theme is kind of killing it?
I think from what I've heard, it might just be in Hollywood, but I don't know. It's got to be on the table.
All right, guys. Well, any other last thoughts on Exorcist, or any thoughts on what you feel could be coming? Scott, I know you mentioned you thought, is this something, is there a trend to this? Do you feel like that's what's happened?
I don't know. It crossed my mind, you know. I think it'd be kind of cool if it was, but being a 70s kid, you know.
Yeah. Maybe the return of the director, a grittier version of the director. See him with like a beard and long hair now. I'd like that. 70s director. Looks like we'll see soon. Last week we said, hey, we'll be a couple of weeks until we get a new house announcement, and we had it in like 3 days.
Yeah. So it is what it's
and look, it's an exciting time. I think it's an exciting time to be a fan of Halloween Horror Nights, and we've known that this since 25, and when you saw, I think, a lot of the fan base kind of all get together and say, yes, this is something we love. I think this year, like you said, this year is the proving point for that fan base to see if this is something that's going to stick around, and for the casual traveler. And we're going to have a lot of people on the show. I'm talking to people this week, old characters. We'll do Inside the Character Studio and talk about what it's like being a character. We'll have on people that made the shows, made the movies, and we're also reaching out to those people that made the IPs that are going to be showcased. But today on the show, we have Jason Sorrell, who, Chris, I believe you're talking to pretty soon, right?
Yeah, I'm catching up with Jason next week, I believe. So, yeah, it'd be great.
Well, Jason's an awesome guy, and he was happy to sit down at his house, and I was at my house, and we spoke about Halloween Horror Nights, his history there. I don't want to spoil too much. There's some great stories. If you like the interview with Julie, I have a feeling you're going to like this one even more. So let's go to our interview with Jason Sorrell. We are thrilled today to be joined by a legend when it comes to dealing with Halloween Horror Nights, and also, you guys know I do a Disney podcast, so for those people, we'll ask a Disney question, but we're not really going to get into that much. I know you're going, oh, come on. Because now, Jason, you're back with Universal right now, right?
Yes, I am back at Universal, only this time with Universal Creative. But yep, I'm back at Universal after 15 years at Walt Disney Imagineering.
Yeah, to give everyone a little background, because I honestly knew of you because of your work at Disney when Imagineering, whether it was the, I've read the, obviously if I'm a Halloween Horror Nights fan, I'm also a huge Haunted Mansion fan. So reading your Haunted Mansion book, I was there at the panel at Star Wars Celebration when Star Tours was announced, Star Tours Adventures Continue. So that's where I know of you from. For those that don't know, though, previously to that, previous to working at Disney, you were working at Universal. Why don't you tell us, for the listeners maybe that don't know, including myself, prior to even Halloween Horror Nights or Fright Nights, whichever it was when you started working, what was your role at Universal?
Well, I actually started at Universal as a writer, as a consultant. Prior to that, I was actually, and this is going back to my college years, but I was working as a character at Disney Entertainment. And in the fall of 1993, as fate would have it, one of my fellow performers, a wonderful guy named Charles Graham, who has since passed away, he just casually mentioned to me at one point, you know, I know one of the ladies, you know, that's behind Halloween Horror Nights. And, you know, I'd be happy to give you her name and number because I had already done a few entertainment experiences kind of as an extracurricular activity when I was still a character performer. So he said, yeah, her name's Julie Zimmerman, and I'll give her give you her phone number, because we didn't even have email back then. So that tells you how far back we're going.
For those who don't know, Julie was obviously the first guest we had on this show. And the reason I even contacted you, reached out to you via Twitter, is she said, oh, and then I gave some young kid this script to real write for Bill and Ted. So those of you guys who want to connect the dots, there's how you connect. That's how we ended up having Jason on. So go ahead, though. Continue.
Oh, I was actually just on that note, I was thrilled that you said you had Julie on, because I don't think Julie gets nearly enough credit for the phenomenon that Halloween Horror Nights is today and the phenomenon that it became. She was absolutely vital to its creation and to the evolution of what it turned into. And as I mentioned, when we were tweeting at each other, I would not have a career if it weren't for Julie Zimmerman. So I'm thrilled that she's getting a little love, getting a little press.
Yeah, we were thrilled to have her on. Yeah, when she started Honor Story, because we didn't really know what to expect, because we got connected through her, through John Paul Gertz, who said, you got to interview Julie. And I said, okay, we'll interview Julie. And she came on. And when she started, it was all of a sudden, it all just came together of, yeah, people are credited as the creator of Halloween Horror Nights. But really, when she started coming down to it, the stuff she started spewing was clearly that she's not the sole person to be credited, but definitely, especially even the stuff that's still happening today, highly influential on everything that went down.
Oh, absolutely. Julie and John Paul. And, I like to think that I was there during the early formative years, but those two in particular were there at ground level, ground zero.
Right.
For Halloween Horror Nights. So, I contacted her, and then she said, I actually contacted her as soon as I got the contact info, as you can imagine, because I was excited and a young kid trying to get something going. And she said, well, as you might imagine, we're a little busy now, and then we roll right into Christmas, but why don't you give me a call after the first of the year? And when you're 24 years old, you're like, oh, that's a kiss off. I'm never going to hear back from her. She's never going to see me. But I did contact her in early 1994, and she called me in, and we met, and I showed her the sort of meager entertainment offerings and shows that I'd put together at Disney. And I think it's it's really a testament to how lean and mean and young Universal Studios Florida was at the time that she was even able to take a chance on somebody like me, but she did. And in that initial meeting, she gave me some assignments. I think the first ones were to come up with some show ideas beyond Bill and Ted and some of the existing offerings. So I remember I pitched a show called A Shadow in the Night, which was inspired by what I was sure was going to be one of the hits of summer 1994, The Shadow, starring Alec Baldwin. Needless to say, that did not go anywhere. But out of that early batch of concepts came a show that we did wind up doing for a couple of years called The Price is Fright, which was a takeoff on The Price is Right, obviously, but starring Beetlejuice. So that was the first of many shows and events that I wrote or directed featuring Beetlejuice, so I got to know him really well. And then I remember after that that first meeting where we reviewed what I'd already done, she said, okay, now let's see what you can come up with for Bill and Ted. And I almost passed out, because Bill and Ted was, in 1994, going into its third year, even though it would only have been the second show created, because they did the same show in 92 and 93.
Gotcha.
And as far as I know, it was Julie's idea to resurrect those characters, you know, after the two films that they had been in. And I know the show was inspired by the ever popular hanging show at Knott's Scary Farm, you know, their annual Halloween haunt.
Yeah, she mentioned both of those in the interview, that the Bill and Ted thing definitely was her idea, and that she definitely had visited Knott's Scary and had to amp it up a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was the same show in 92 and 93. So what I tried to do was, you know, to bring something new to it, I thought, well, all right, we'll take the bones of what we have. Because if I remember correctly, that first show, you know, had Bill and Ted and Doc Brown and I think versions of Freddy and Jason and some of the kind of slasher characters. And there was a musical finale. But it was mostly a reinterpretation of the Wild West show featuring those characters. So I thought, because I was, you know, desperate to kind of bring something new to it and show that I could do this stuff, I went in and thought, well, what if we treated this basically like a 25-minute Saturday Night Live sketch that also happens to feature stunts, pyrotechnics, and a big musical finale? And I thought, and I had never seen the hanging, so some of what I was bringing to the table, I thought was original thinking, even though it was very similar to what they did at the Not Great Scary Farm.
Great minds.
But the idea was, okay, what I'd really love to do to make it timely is let's take one of the big films of the year, and it turned out not to be one of the big films of the year, but in a couple of months, at that time, Time Cop, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, was coming out.
Of course.
I went in and pitched a show called Bill and Ted's Excellent Halloween Adventure 2, Bill and Ted Meet Time Cop. And the central premise, because I was a Disney disciple and dead set on becoming an Imagineer one day, I wanted everything to have a story. So in this version of Bill and Ted, they met up with Time Cop, and they were specifically out to stop these two criminals, you know, who were out to get the phone booth and commit crimes throughout time. And then the other idea was to introduce some of the most famous pop cultural characters from that year. So we had Forrest Gump and The Mask and a number of characters that were in hit films that year. And then, of course, we did the musical finale and employed a lot of the other existing elements. But what I think I brought to it was more of a structured story, more of a conscious attempt to represent the best of the year. And I will never forget, to this day, it's one of the highlights of my career. The night of the employee preview, you know, you can imagine I'm a 24-year-old kid. Really,
that's what I wanted to ask. Yeah, exactly. Seeing it.
Hadn't done much. And I cannot tell you what it was like, employee preview night, to be in the Wild West arena and hear the crowd go absolutely crazy, you know, for stuff that had come out of my head. You know, the jokes were landing. They loved the introduction of these new characters. They loved the music we selected, you know, to make sure the finale kind of brought the whole thing home. You know, when The Mask came out, the place just erupted. And to this day, it's one of the highlights of my career. I'll never forget Universal Entertainment Management coming to me just beaming and giving me a big hug, you know, and looking back on it now, they're like, oh my God, you know, this 24-year-old nothing, you know, just handed us this hit that we weren't expecting. And then I think from then on, the next 4 years, you know, because I was there for a total of 5 years, my goal was just to make it bigger and better and introduce fresh elements each year, but keeping that template that we had established. And that was the template that was in place for many, many years until I think after I left, it got to a point where legally they could no longer do the shows we were doing because they had to go ever so much farther into the realm of satire just to get away with the show.
Yeah, it did seem that way. That you, definitely it's still your format, I'd say that. It's still the grand finale and the parodies, but they definitely seem much more... From even when I started going, let's say, I think I started going in 2000 as a kid or as a teenager, it did go more now into where it's an extreme parody of the character. So it's not, you know, it wouldn't be Captain America. It's, you know, Captain something else who looks like Captain America.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. And I would always tell people at the time, not that I was some great expert, but you know, when you're 24, 25, you think you know everything.
Right.
I would always tell people that to me, the trick for Bill and Ted was to decide just how far to take each character. So for example, in 1995, we had a trio of heroes come in. John McClane, you know, from the Die Hard series, yep. Die Hard with a Vengeance had just come out. The Terminator, who was a fixture of the show, going all the way back to Julie's original, so we had to have the Terminator. And then we had what I will call a Stallone character, and that was, again, where I tried to make the distinction between a hardcore parody and a character who was just kind of there as him or herself. So I think we called the character the Judge, and you know, he came into the Rocky theme, but he had the Judge Dredd helmet on, right, and Rocky boxing shorts, and he was basically there to make fun of Sylvester Stallone. So every line was monosyllabic, and a big part of the fun was watching him interact with John McClane and the Terminator. But that was part of a big part of the fun of the show for me, because John McClane, in my mind, was straight up John McClane, and the fun and the air quotes satire that came in was the fact that he was in this absurd situation that he would never be in.
Right.
Of course, I learned much later that that's not truly
satire. How it goes.
That's not parody. That's copyright infringement. But again, you know, we were flying so far below the radar back then, you could get away with it. I think the first dark rumblings I had during my years was in 1997. I was told toward the end of the run of Halloween, we got a letter from the legal department at Warner Brothers saying, "What's all this about you doing a show with Batman and Robin and Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy?" And,
right.
And we're kind of like, well, there's only two more event nights, so yeah, we'll stop. You know, and that was that. But yeah, I do think Bill and Ted, more than anything, it became a party. And I think what surprised me and what surprised all of us on the team was how much it blew up during the years that I was there. Because like the 5 years that I worked at Universal Studios Florida Entertainment were very much formative years for Halloween Horror Nights. Again, with that sort of Disney influence, yeah. I was dead set on bringing more story and structure and substance to our offerings. So that even extended to the haunted houses, because in the early days, especially with something like Dungeon of Terror, for example, it was just a series of loosely connected scares that really had no storyline to hold it all together. It was just a series of scary scenes. And
haunted house.
Just yeah,
almost a traditional fine. Haunted house. Yeah.
Because that's what a haunted house is. But again, you know, Mr. Junior Imagineer here was like, I'm going to tell stories. You know? So, over the 5 years that I was there, one of the things I'm most proud of is that we did progress to a very rich and detailed storylines for each of the houses with a cast of original characters that we developed. And then there were other houses that sought to bring the best of scary film and television to life, all official, you know, under the radar, of course. And that, you know, it was a little bit bittersweet for me years later to see them actually go out and license some of the properties that I love right. so much and do them for real. I mean, 2 years ago when they did the John Carpenter's Halloween house, you know, I walked through it almost yeah. with tears in my eyes because I was like, we wanted to do this in 1996. You know, in fact, yeah. I even called John Carpenter because I'm a 26-year-old kid thinking, well, this is part of my job, you know, to create.
Yeah,
so I actually got a dialogue going. You know, we talked to Deborah Hill, and she's like, oh, my God, John will love this. Then I get called into an executive's office saying, what's all this about you reaching out to John Carpenter? And I'm like, well, I thought it'd be fun to do a Halloween house for Halloween.
Right.
Well, you represented yourself as Universal Studios Florida. And I'm like, yes, and? You
know, I thought that was
So that was a quick lesson in celebrity relations and how to go after intellectual property. But, you know, one of the things that is gratifying is to see that the notion of solid storylines. And I created a document for each haunted house that we called the Bible, you know, that had the storyline and took you through room by room. And it would say what the distraction scare was, and then what the boo scare was, and then what the special effects were, what characters were in there. And that was a template that they kept for a long time afterwards. And in the years after I left, the houses became even more story driven, and you know, the icons rose out of that. So I really feel proud of the work that we did during the 5 years I was there to really kind of lay the foundation for what Halloween would become. And now it's just a phenomenon with these wonderful original stories that they're telling in the houses, and then these amazing adaptations of beloved IP, and then you know what they've done with the website and just deepening the experience. I mean, it's really incredible, you know, what it's become.
Yeah, we're in April and we already know what the first house is. So that shows you what's happening with the fan community of this. It has been insane. What years were you there, Jason?
1994 through 98. So that's 5 years worth, five events. Again, to this day, what I love most were the five Bill and Ted's. And I wrote it for the first 2 years I was there, and then got the director's chair in 96. So then my last three, I was able to write and direct. So that was really a thrill. My favorite show to this day was the one we did in 1997. It was called Bill and Ted's Excellent Halloween Adventure, The Final Frontier. And the whole thing had kind of a Star Trek storyline where Kirk and Picard teamed up to defeat the Borg, who were the Borg had joined forces with the Klingon Krug from Star Trek III. So we had a Christopher Lloyd Klingon, and their goal was to steal the phone booth again so that they could wreak havoc throughout time and space. But that to this day, I think is my favorite one, but
we will try to find a copy of that, or someone that's maybe someone videotaped it on old, you know, camcorder, and maybe it's on YouTube. I have not seen that show. I need to, because my wife and I are big Star Trek Next Generation fans. My son's name is Riker because of that.
Oh, so that's fantastic.
I have to go watch this now, man. That's going to be great. Now, a lot of us dream of writing that show. Can you walk us through a little bit of the process of what it was? Obviously, they're still using that same framework, like you said, you know, that they did today. But the actual sitting down and writing it, was it just, oh, I find this funny? Or was it a step-by-step working with Universal Creative or whoever it was, Universal Lawyers, to map out what the story ended up being?
No, in those early days, it was absolutely, you know, just us in our little special events group there at Entertainment. And for the most part, you know, Julie was there the first 2 years that I did it. And she would supervise what I was doing, and she would chime in with ideas and throw things out as well. But for the most part, it was just me sitting there thinking, well, what do I think is funny? And Bill and Ted was one of those things that really became a year-long job. And that's something that I am sure is still holds true today, where, you know, you'd see something on television or see a movie or characters that were really connecting, you know, with the culture. And you'd be like, oh, my God, they're going to be in the show. In 1995, for example, I knew I wanted to use Jules and Vincent from Pulp Fiction, which had come out almost a year earlier, but that film just kind of captured everyone's imagination.
It resonated with everybody for still.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you always knew you'd made the right decision when a character or characters would enter, and you would just wait for the crowd to tell you how you did. You know, and there was, it became a rush, you know, when you knew you'd nailed it. And you know, I was talking about the show from 1997. One of my finest moments was when the DeLorean comes out right before the musical finale, you know, to the Back to the Future music that then segues into the Seinfeld theme. Those doors open and the four Seinfeld characters pop out. The crowd went absolutely crazy. And, That was a personal triumph for me, because I'm such a Seinfeld and Larry David disciple.
Of course. I think we all are. Now, the Bill and Ted show, that does bring me up, you know, Larry David and all these kind of IPs that you were able to kind of joke around about. The show can get, and I'm not sure if it was like this in the 90s, can get pretty, let's say PG-13, maybe sometimes R, when it comes to language being used, you know, the topics, the dancers, everything that happens. Was that originally something that you guys had intended to? Because it seems, even when I take people for the first time to Halloween Horror Nights now, and they're like, you got to see Bill and Ted. Bill and Ted is kind of the iconic piece we always have to go to. Make sure we hit everything, but we got to hit Bill and Ted. They're always taken aback a little bit. Like, this is happening in Universal Studios? Like, this is insane.
the envelope kept getting pushed and pushed and pushed. And I don't know that it's by design. I think some of it is, there is a little bit of element of, well, what are we going to give them this year? How are we going to push things further? I will take the credit or the blame for introducing swearing. That was in 97. But again, it originated out of character and not sensationalism. We had Ripley, you know, from the Alien franchise. And there's a moment where the Borg Queen is menacing Bill and Ted. So she machine guns her way through a wall, trains her gun on the Borg Queen, and we had to do the classic line from Alien. So she goes, "Get away from them, you bitch." And the crowd just went crazy. Crazy because, you know, there's cursing in a theme park.
Shocked a little bit in a good way.
and also crazy because it was a classic line. And then we made it a running joke. So for the, I think one or two times throughout the rest of the show, she'd take pot shots at the Borg Queen and just yell, "Bitch." And then in the last year I did it in 1998, we had Scully and Mulder from The X-Files kind of in a confrontation with T.J. Hooker because the Kirk character had gone over so well in 97. I brought the same actor, Dan Johnson, who is just a comedic secret weapon. So if you need comedy in whatever you're doing, call Dan Johnson.
Call Dan Johnson. All right. Well, we do a lot of work in television, film, and podcasting, so I'm sure I'll write it down.
But so there was a moment where they were T.J. Hooker was kind of getting into it with Scully and Mulder, and Mulder's like, "Well, I'm going to take over your investigation from you," and he goes, "You and what army, bitch?" And you know, and at that point, and that brought the house down. But at that point, even I was doing it just to do it because you could.
Right.
You know, but now it's like, yeah, the language is kind of all over the place. And, you know, there's a lot of scantily clad girls running around and guys, too.
Yeah. Have you seen the show recently? Did you go last year?
Yeah, I've seen it the past couple of years since I've been back. And it was an adjustment in a good way, you know, because you're just like, wow. Because you realize that there's no way they could get away with the shows that we did. And kind of on the flip side of that, I'm looking at it going, oh my gosh, I don't even know if I could do this show anymore because it's such a different animal.
Right.
You know, and it's such a different thing.
What is your role now at Universal? I know, do your hands touch Halloween Horror Nights at all? Or what do you do with creative?
I collaborate with Mike Aiello, who's the creative director of the event, on a number of other projects. So we always talk about Halloween quite a bit. And occasionally I'd be like, oh, what about this property? Or have you thought about this? And there's actually something coming up that hasn't been announced yet. It's a huge dream come true of mine. And I know Mike's thrilled as well. You'll
want to tell anyone. Come on.
This is just us.
No one's hearing this.
But you'll know it when you hear it.
I can't wait.
But we're both so busy in our respective worlds that the only time we truly get to collaborate is when those worlds kind of cross over, you know, kind of like all the wonderful work he did for Diagon Alley. We have a project coming up that has a really wonderful live entertainment component, and it's been an absolute joy to work with him and all the folks at Entertainment because it's an amazing group they have over there.
Yeah, Mike is a friend of mine, or I've known him throughout the last couple of years, and I think we're going to have him on. As those things are released, I told him, I want you to come on and break some news, whatever you're most excited about. So hopefully he comes on for the both of your dream project, which I can't wait to hear.
Well, he'll know what I'm referring to. So if you ask him about it, he'll know exactly which experience I'm talking about.
All right. Well, I can't wait for that. Now, you obviously then left. I know we're getting close on time, so I'll wrap it up here. But you left Universal for a number of years and went to go work for Disney, and became sort of a face for Imagineering in some ways. You know, we saw you, like I said, I saw you at cons. I met you out at D23 years ago, and you know, there's all these other elements. People know you from the Haunted Mansion book. Like my 3-year-old, 3.5-year-old son, he just rode the Haunted Mansion for the first time, and when I asked him, what was your favorite part? And he left going, this is awesome. He said the Leota gravestone, you know, with the eyes opening.
And, oh, that's fantastic.
And he always tells me that whenever we bring it up, I go, what's your favorite part of the Haunted Mansion? Because he loves the Haunted Mansion, which he's daddy's boy. And he said, every time he's like, man, that tomb, he doesn't know it's a tomb. He's like, that statue that the eyes open out front. I'm like, yeah, I know, man. That's one of my favorites. Obviously, you were working in the world of spooky there as well. But one thing that is very reminiscent of Bill and Ted that I was able to experience, which was, forgive me if I'm getting, was it Raiders of the Lost Jedi Temple of Doom?
Yeah, that was... that was a lot of fun. That was for the a special show just for the last Tour of Endor event, you know, when we closed down Star Tours in anticipation of the new one. And it's funny you say that, because that was extremely intentional on my part. It was because after having been away from Universal for so long, I thought, oh my gosh, I have a chance to do a Bill and Ted style show again. And that was actually not even the original concept. I don't think anyone knows this, but the original show we were going to do was actually called George and Steve's Epic Adventure. And the show was going to feature George Lucas and Steven Spielberg as characters making Indy 5. And the central conceit of the show was that George kind of went off the deep end and said, well, you know, people love Indiana Jones and people love Star Wars, so why don't we just, you know, put them together? And Spielberg was just kind of this semi-unwilling accomplice. But I really wish we'd been able to do it, because it featured, you know, kind of someone playing Harrison Ford, playing Indy. So they were all the real players. Right. And even the folks at Lucasfilm that initially read some of my early drafts thought it was absolutely hysterical. But then I think someone from marketing got a hold of it on the Lucas side and said, yeah, we don't want to do this.
That's too bad, because I was in the audience for that. And by the way, if you want to leak any of those scripts, those early scripts, we'd be happy to, you know, keep them to ourselves. Because those are things I'd love to read. I'd love to see some of these works that never made it. But that one, so my wife and I are there, and we're big Star Wars geeks. Obviously, we're at Star Wars Celebration, and we're Disney geeks, and we're just in general geeks. And we named our child after a Star Trek character. So we're there sitting in. We got sat in the theater, and then about five rows in front of us, all of a sudden, George Lucas walks in with his family.
Oh, that one, because that's the one that's on YouTube that got all the videos. Yes. That's the specific performance. So you saw the that was the one that Seth Green was at as well.
Seth Green and Jamie King, and I mean, talk about it. It had to be a surreal experience. It was a surreal experience for me as just a hardcore Lucasite, as well as someone who you know worships the ground of George Lucas, to be sitting a few rows in front of him watching essentially a Star Wars Indiana Jones show. But for you, what did you have an idea that he was coming to the show, and what was that experience like?
Oh yeah, we knew he was coming, and you know I had met him on a number of occasions before, including when we pitched Star Tours: The Adventures Continue to him
the
first time. I had kind of acclimated to the idea of being around him, even though it's something I never thought I would quote unquote get used to. But that one was stressful, because you never really know how he's going to react, but he seemed to enjoy it. And then Lynn Hale, who's just a wonderful longtime Lucasfilm veteran, who was his personal publicist and is now continues to be head of publicity for Lucasfilm. Afterwards, she came up to me, she goes, I'm so proud of you, honey. And she goes, come here. And she grabs me and takes me over to George. And she goes, George, this is Jason. Remember him? He wrote and directed the show. And he kind of turned to me and he shakes my hand. He goes, oh, that was really great. You know, you did a great job of, you know, putting the worlds together.
Yeah. I know if I need a George Lucas, who to call now. So maybe you can cut our intro to this podcast.
But yeah, that was a great night. And then also working with all of the Star Wars personalities, you know, when we knew we had Seth Green, we thought, okay, well, we're going to have one of the characters diss Robot Chicken and just have him kind of walk out totally indignant. And that got a huge reaction.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was during the night, during the event itself, I got kind of an emergency phone call, and they said, okay, Mark Hamill decided he wants to do it. So we need to figure out how to get him in the last show. So I said, well, my God, we got to put him on the X-Wing float and have him blow up the flying wing. So, you know, we kind of met with him at the last minute and walked him through it. And again, he could not have been more game and have more fun with it. But that night was just incredibly surreal, as you might imagine.
I mean, I didn't know that happened. So I'm glad I saw the George Lucas Seth Green show just to be there with George. But the Mark Hamill flying an X-Wing would have been pretty unreal. So I guess just to wrap it up, because look, we went on. I had to go look for my Disney people. I had to go on a little Disney tangent there. We had to talk about it for a little bit. But you're back at Universal. What is your role there, and what can people kind of expect? Where can they see your fingerprints coming up?
Well, the whole reason I took the job was they offered me a position as a creative director, which for someone who's been a writer for many years, it was literally the proverbial offer you can't refuse. And then when you look at, I was a Universal veteran, so the concept of going back was not really in any way foreign to me. You know, it was like a homecoming in many ways. But, you know, between obviously the Harry Potter work and all of the work that they have planned for the next 5 years, it's just kind of astounding. So I jumped at the opportunity. My first assignment you'll be seeing in roughly the next year or so. It's Race Through New York, starring Jimmy Fallon. That was the first assignment they gave me. And that was a shocker. I mean, you know, my first phone call with the executive producer for the studio, you know, he's like, all right, well, I want to let you know what you'll be working on so you can kind of get your feet wet and hit the ground running on your first day. So I'm thinking he's going to, you know, hit me with a name like King Kong or Harry Potter.
Right.
He goes, Jimmy Fallon. And I go, what about him? And he's like, he's getting his own ride and we need you to figure it out. And I'm like, okay. But it was, the funny thing is, you know, I have long been kind of a late night, disciple. You know, I've been a lifelong Carson and Letterman fan. And, so working in that world actually, immediately appealed to me. The trick was finding the right story to feel like it was a natural fit with the property. Like, what, you know, obviously a late night talk show is not a natural IP for a thrill ride. So cracking
and something
that
goes wrong.
Yeah. And but cracking that code was a big part of the fun. And I'll never forget that kind of eureka moment when I'm like, oh my gosh, the races, you know, he already does these crazy outlandish races on the show in these weird vehicles with celebrities and goes in and out of the building. So taking that as kind of the germ of the idea was what allowed us to build a kind of a classic Universal thrill ride out of it. And I do think people are really going to dig what they see when we open this one. We're in active production right now, and construction is underway on the back lot. And we will see you in 2017 with that one.
That's awesome, Jason. We'll definitely have to bring you back on when you can talk to us more about that experience and whatever you're doing next with Universal, because that's outstanding. I mean, everyone loved the idea. I mean, at least I did. I'm not sure about everyone. When Jimmy Fallon was announced to have his own ride, I think that's a lot of fun. I'm a late night disciple as well. Went to one of the last Letterman tapings. Again, schlepped my wife up to New York to watch Jack Hanna, which she loved Jack Hanna on his final appearance. So, you know, I have a shrine to Letterman in my office. So to have an experience like that, that's so uniquely too tied to an American pop culture figure, I think is so interesting, because like, you're right, there's Kong, there's Potter, there's, you know, all these big IPs that are throughout the entire thing, but to have the Tonight Show represented, I think is really great. It's great for even, like I said, the international viewers who may come, who may not know of Jimmy Fallon, but can be introduced to something a little different.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I think people are also going to be really pleasantly surprised when they see what it does to the New York area of the backlot, because it does nothing but strengthen that particular story and really bring that area together. So that's kind of a ancillary benefit, you know, to using this property. So we got that going. And then I'm also creative director currently for the Universal Beijing theme park. So I've been working with kind of at the theme park level, helping them formulate what the lands and attractions are going to be. And that's, you know, as you can imagine, a dream come true to have the opportunity to work on an entire park from, you know, from the early days onward. So, you know, it's just been a wonderful experience. And I've been able to stretch my wings in ways that I didn't even imagine. So it's really been a wonderful move for me. Bittersweet, because, Disney veterans obviously have a strong emotional tie to that company and the properties and Walt himself. But again, in a way, I thought, well, what would Walt want me to do? You know, Walt would want me to grow, you know, as a person and as a creative person. And that's certainly been the case with this. And it's paid off in ways that I couldn't have foreseen.
Well, Jason, thank you so much. This was enlightening for a lot of us as Halloween Horror Nights fans, Universal fans, even Disney fans got a lot out of that. And I really appreciate it. How can people, or if you want them to, how can people follow you, stay in touch with you, and know what's going on?
Well, I am on Twitter at Jason Sorrell. And mostly I just try to, you know, make snarky comments on things. But occasionally you'll get a little nugget of theme park news in there. And occasionally in the future, you will get some Universal tidbits after I've cleared it with marketing and legal, of course.
The fun part.
Yeah. So there's that. I've got a couple of book ideas in the hopper that I'm still toying with. There's a Lucas book, a Marvel book, and I might actually be doing a trilogy of kind of young adult supernatural novels. So I have that coming. So there's a lot going on. And but most of my time, obviously, will be devoted to Universal Creative and all the work we're doing with the Fallon Project and Universal Beijing.
Well, fine. I won't be sitting here pitching you all my ideas. It's fine.
All right. Yes. I'll have a lawyer break down this door.
Sure. All right. Thank you, Jason. I really appreciate it. Thank you for being on our podcast here.
Sure. No, it's my pleasure. And I will try to digitize my Bill and Ted shows and get them out there, because I do have them burned to DVD. I just need to digitize them and upload them somewhere, because I do think people would get a kick out of Bill and Ted from the old days.
We will. We'll leak them out there just perfectly for you. Thank you, Jason. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Jason Sorrell. We're going to have guests like that coming up each episode on Scare Zone Halloween Horror Nights podcast. Now, we're going to release at least 2 times a month. We've talked about that before, but yeah, you're going to start getting a regular schedule. So we'll announce when the next episode's coming up very soon. But I thank you all for listening, and thanks to Scott. Scott, how can people reach out to you, follow you on Twitter? What's the best way for them to become part of this, the Scotty Too Hottie Nation?
Everything, all of my social media is at the Scotty Too Hottie. That's S-C-O-T-T-Y with the number 2, H-O-T-T-Y. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all the same. I try to stay on there and stay busy on there, but yeah, you know, and keep everybody.
Yeah, reach out to Scott, let him know you heard the show, and also, hey, if Scott's coming to your area wrestling, go out and see him. Follow Scott, and he also, because that's Scott's eBay business, we'll link that. Chris, tell us about your website and book and how people can also reach out to you.
The website, our blog is hhnunofficial.com. The book, Halloween Horror Nights, the Unofficial Story and Guide. The previous one is still available, but the new one...
And worth a read, because for people to know, majority of that book is story.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably 80% story. Best place to get it, in fact, the cheapest place to get it is Amazon, amazon.com. So, yeah, and they say the new one should be available very, very soon.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this week on Scare Zone Halloween Horror Nights podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. And as always, keep your eyes closed and your ears open. We'll talk to you on the next show.
Visit our website, scarezone.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/scarezone. And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/scpodcast. And remember to rate and review us on iTunes. This has been a production of LaFo Brand Studios. Copyright 2016.